Oliver Callan on RTÉ Radio 1, sponsored by Get Set Go. Get comprehensive car insurance today at getsetgo.ie.
Oliver Callan on RTÉ Radio 1.
Dermot Whelan in for Oliver, and we've got a fantastic guest in studio. Kind of pinching myself a little bit here. He's an actor, a comedian. He was 1/6 of Monty Python and the star of wonderful films like A Fish Called Wanda and The Death of Stalin. He's also a globe-trotting documentary presenter and best-selling author, and he joins us to chat about his latest travels to the beautiful but dangerous Venezuela, and of course about his new book of the same name as well. Sir Michael Palin, good morning.
Good morning. I thought you were going to say the beautiful but dangerous Dublin for a minute, you know. My most recent travels. Yeah.
You were in Dublin last night giving a talk in Trinity. How did it go?
It went very well, yes. I mean, it's a talk about Venezuela. Not many people here have seen the Venezuela television programme because it was on Channel 5. But
it is on Virgin Media here.
Is it?
Yeah, and I've been enjoying it. Yeah, good. Episode 2 was on last night.
Well, I was just, you know, taking people through it from my point of view with lots of visuals and all that, and people seem to be... I mean, it's a very happy place in one way, Venezuela, but also a very sad place politically. It's a real mess at the moment, and Trump is bombing any small boat that leaves the shores of Venezuela and sending it to the bottom of the sea for some reason. So
yes, the worst thing you can say in Venezuela at the moment is, I'm just popping out for a spot of fishing.
Yes, that's right, yes. You know? I'm just going off for a smoke.
Yeah. I mean, last time I saw you, you were in your socks standing behind a waterfall.
Yes. That was extremely intrepid, very silly. And to do it at the age of 81 was extraordinary. That was on the journey.
Yeah.
And they said, you know, you can walk behind this waterfall. And there was a terrific waterfall, very strong, very powerful. And you can walk behind it, but you can't wear shoes because you'll slip over. I thought, what? Slip over? You're going clambering across shattered rocks anyway. There's no sort of bars to hold on to or anything like that. It's the absolute antithesis of health and safety.
I know. Well, my heart was in my mouth watching. I was like, he's going to fall. Oh, Jesus, he's going to fall. Let's have a clip of you behind the waterfall, because this is from episode 1 of your series, Venezuela. And... I think it just captures your childlike enthusiasm for life, which is one of the reasons why we love you. Have a listen.
I mean, things were really bad and they still are, but we had a huge food crisis, shortages. You could not find food to eat. You could not find...
We'll come back to that in
that
a second.
That wasn't me.
That wasn't
That's
you.
Before I had my voice fixed. I do many parts, you know.
Mm. Okay, we've got it now. Let's play it.
I think this is the retirement moment, isn't it, really? I'm sorry we've got a series to finish, but I'm not doing any more. I'm just going to retire now. Here. There's a nice seat. Just sit down. Oh, practice retirement. Oh, this is what it is. Oh. Nowhere better.
Ah, there you are behind the waterfall.
Well, I wasn't behind the waterfall. I was looking at the waterfall from this lovely place called the Waco Lodge. It was entirely run by animals, this lodge. They have this, it was where the waterfall was.
Yeah.
But they have this idea that animals should be able to wander through the grounds at any time. And when we checked out, we could only find a monkey and a tapir at reception. It's very difficult to find a human being to pay. But there was a parrot there, which I thought was very suitable. Claimed to know John Cleese, but I don't know if it did.
Well, Venezuela is an interesting place because it did have a very impressive heyday. It was, I guess, the sort of socialist jewel in the crown. And it experienced a massive decline, though, then, didn't it?
Well, it was, first of all, it was a capitalist jewel in the crown. When the Americans were there in the 1970s and 80s, they've got enormous oil resources there. The Americans were running the oil business. A huge amount of money was going into Venezuela. It had an economy bigger than Spain at one point. And then when Hugo Chavez, who's a Venezuelan sort of guy from the country, took over in 1999, it went the other way and became a socialist paradise for a very few years. But he tried to change everything, got rid of all the people who ran the, all the Americans who ran the oil business, and put Venezuelans in there, which is fine, except they didn't know quite what to do and how to run it. And the oil boom faded, and Chavez died about 10 years on. Now having real trouble because they've got a man called Maduro who is a chauvinista, but he's not popular. And he didn't win. He thought he won the last election, but he didn't. He just stayed in power. So there's quite a lot of nasty stuff going on below the surface. But it's a beautiful country, absolutely wonderful.
But it's really striking in the documentary where you see he's put up these huge images of himself as the president. He's got a three-hour TV show. Which you're sitting in your hotel room watching, sort of bewildered at him just on, dancing around with people. And
no, well, he's not an easy mover. You see him dancing around. He looks real dad dancing. But I mean, this is the thing about dictators. They put big posters of themselves up almost everywhere they go, you know.
Yeah.
And he has this cartoon character created around him, which I found utterly unbelievable. It's called Super Bigot. And I thought, this is so great. There's satire in Venezuela. But Bigot means moustache. And the one distinguishing thing about Maduro is he does have a very large moustache. So they created this character called Super Moustache, and they dress him like Superman. So he rushes around, and you see sort of cartoons of him zapping the opposition and knocking them on the head, people who have won the Nobel Peace Prize, one of the opposition did recently. So she's dressed as a witch and all that. So it's kind of weird, infantile publicity going on for him.
Not the safest place for you or any traveller going there. Although, when I look at the list of places you've been, North Korea and all the other places, you're like, maybe Michael should get a new travel agent.
Yes.
Just 2 weeks in Tenerife. You might love it.
Well, we go to Dangerous Travel Inc.
Yeah. But you were up around the barrios, the slums and, home to criminal gangs and all kinds of things. Did you feel safe while you were there?
If the people, can we work very closely with people on the ground? You've got to do that. And if they feel it's safe, I'll go with them. Sometimes you get the feeling that there could be danger. And very often you don't know quite what's going on. Mm. But I trust people to say, it's okay, Michael, you can go there. You will not lose your life, whatever. But no one stopped me going behind the waterfall where I could have, that could have been the last thing. Yeah, Matt, I remember shouting when I was under the waterfall, I shouldn't be doing this. I'm 81. I should be in bed. But it was a nice rebellious shout. It was like bringing out the kid in me again. At 81, I could still be a sort of silly 17-year-old.
Yeah, but I guess you've a very open mind and an open approach to these. I mean, you also allowed yourself to be flown by a helicopter right into the Angel Falls, onto where it landed on what looked like a very slippery rock.
Yes.
You were quite comfortable there as well.
Yeah. No, I was terrified. Well, I wasn't terrified, but there are certain times when you just have to go with the action.
Yeah.
And you're usually helped out by somebody who will know what's going on. But then, this was the helicopter took us to the base of the Angel Falls, which is the tallest waterfall in the world. There's a kilometre of free-flowing water. And we got there and people very rarely can get to the bottom of the waterfall. So when I stood there, I just thought, this is why I do this job. And I keep wanting to surprise myself and will continue to want to surprise myself as I get older.
In those countries, there's always a sense that you're being watched, that you never have total free reign. There is a moment in the second episode where the authorities catch up with you and all your bag and baggage are put out onto the road. Tell us about that experience and how did you get out of it?
Well, we were stopped from filming for some reason in Hugo Chavez's birthplace. And eventually, we weren't just stopped by the local police, we were stopped by the intelligence agency. And they come along and they've got black uniforms, they've got bulletproof jackets, they've got assault rifles, night vision goggles, all this for us, you know. And they inspected all our bags, photographed everything, and then said, you can't film, you've got to stay till we get instructions. So we ended up having some food in a nearby restaurant. And the men with guns were on one table and we were on the other. And it was really kind of totally surreal. Mm. And one of the guys, the paramilitary, said, who is this man? So he said, oh, he's Michael Palin. He's a comedian. So he then looks me up on YouTube. And what they get, what they find on YouTube is John Cleese and myself debating, or rather having a very strong argument with the Bishop of Southwark and Malcolm Muggeridge about the life of Brian back in 1979. And they they look very, very weird, these guys frowning and say, he's not funny, not really funny. So I said, well, show them Monty Python. So then again, they try and tap in Monty Python and they got the fish slapping dance, which is where I hit John with a couple of pilchards several times. He knocks me into the canal. And then you could just see that their rifles sort of shaking and their night vision goggles clouding up as they enjoyed it. So I felt we'd won a battle there. They realised we were not dangerous people. I was an extremely silly person.
Yes, unless you're armed with a fish, in which case you could be.
Yeah.
You know, there's a text here that describes your approach to it nicely. And it says, it's from a fan in Wexford, says, I'm such a big fan of Sir Michael Palin. I absolutely love his travel programs. And above all, I admire the kindness and empathy he extends to everyone he meets in his travels, no matter their race, colour or creed. He's a true gentleman. And I wish him many more years of good health and fun. He's a real divil, as the Irish like to say. Mm. And we wish him loads more travel adventures. I think that's what people do connect with. You do have a natural empathy and openness. Was that always there? Are you aware of it? Or is it some kind of feedback you get from people in general?
Yeah, I try to be honest and open with people. And I'm very curious about the people I meet and what their lives are like. I think that's the thing about my travel programs. I'm not trying to say I know everything and I'm going to this country and I'm going to tell my home audience exactly about it. I'm hoping to, you know, change people's minds about the countries I go to, give them an insight into them. And that means listening to people, talking to people, exchanging food with people, visiting their houses if you can. And that, I think, that pays dividends. You really do then get the feeling that the people you're visiting have, it's their voice you're hearing. And I'm just terribly curious and always have been.
How did the travel bug come about? Because I think you were in your mid-40s when you started doing this.
Well, I think from when I was very, very small, I used to enjoy moving on, going from one place to another. Mm. In fact, my mother said you used to put me out in the pram, and I obviously didn't like being in the pram. I liked the pram to move, so I would take all my clothes off one by one. And so someone had to come out before I died of exposure, put the clothes back on, and run me down the road in the pram. So I think very early on, I wanted to be in changing circumstances.
Yeah, but did you think you'd have such a long, successful career in the business of doing travel shows?
No, I didn't particularly. I did Around the World in 80 Days. I was asked to do that out of the blue. And five people had turned it down already. But once I saw the audience reaction to that, I felt, well, this is a kind of freedom. I've always loved different parts of the world. I used to love books about foreign adventures, Biggles going off to the Gobi Desert and all that. So the chance to be taken there by myself seemed good. And we did Pole to Pole as a follow-up, and that worked. Mm. And so it went on.
And what did your wife think at the time when you said, I think I'm going to travel all over the world, and did she get to come with you?
My wife was rather suspiciously in favour of me going on long journeys. Sorry. And she was actually really good, because I was away for quite a long period certain times, you know, well, 80 days, I was away for 80 days. She's very good. She was very practical. She looked after the children. And I think she knew that it was better that I should go than I should not go.
Yeah.
Because otherwise I'd be at home sort of kicking the furniture and saying, oh, why didn't I go around the world when I was asked to do it?
So I'd be out in the garden taking all your clothes off.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Desperate to go somewhere.
Yes, I'd be walking down the street saying, please.
Our deepest condolences on the loss of your wife, Helen. I know
well,
in 2023, what have the last couple of years been like for you?
Thank you. Well, very, very odd, really. A constant readjustment to start with. It's very intense grief. You kind of live this strange life where you imagine that then they're still going to come back. The word illusion, no, it's only temporary. There's so much of her in my life, so much of her in the house and all that. She's got to come back. But then you realise, of course, that's not going to happen. And then I just said, well, how would she like to see me carry on? What would she like to see me doing? And I think about a lot of the time. And I think about what she'd say if I were asked to do this or asked to do that. Mm. She was always very, very strong-willed. And if there was something wasn't good, she'd say, look, you don't want to do this, do you? And I said, well, no, you really don't. I can tell. So I don't have anybody at the moment who really, and I never will, who will know me that well. But the echo of our 50 years together is always there in the back of my mind.
Yeah.
And I'm always thinking about what she would like to see me doing.
Yeah, someone sends an interesting message in saying one of Michael's very first travel shows was a train journey around Ireland. I stumbled across it recently and was captivated by how it felt like another world. Absolutely gorgeous. Do you remember that one?
I do remember it. It was actually, it was after I'd done Around the World in 80 Days, but it was in 1993. I remember that because it was my 50th birthday. Mm. And we did a railway journey from Derry to Kerry, and the sun shone all the time, and it was rather wonderful. And we stayed at a hotel on my actual birthday, and I was a bit sad that I wasn't at home. But I'd planned a little sort of meal for the crew and all that, and we were going to have some champagne to start with. And we just sat there, and the crew were there, and they said, oh, the champagne, we've got a new waitress, I'm sorry, it's going to be a bit late, really sorry. And I felt the whole birthday thing was falling apart, and then the doors opened, and in came Helen with a tray of champagne, you know, and they brought her over, and I was completely wrong-footed. I didn't know this was happening at all, and it was very touching. So it was a lovely birthday present in the end, down in Mallow, I was.
Yeah. Yeah, fantastic. We have to talk about Monty Python because, you know, I wonder sometimes, do you feel like Sting? And when people go, can we ask you about the Police? And you're like, for the love of God, I did that so long ago. But it's so a part of people's psyche and memory and inspiration. Yeah. It had greatly inspired me when I was, I think I discovered Monty Python around the age of 10. And just, I remember going to Shannonside Video in Dordoyle Shopping Centre and renting the Flying Circus videos.
It's interesting you say inspiration. I mean, what was, how did that manifest itself with you in terms of being inspiration? Are you doing something different from what you did before?
Well, it made me as a kid, when I saw that you could be surreal, when I saw things like The Knights Who Say Ni, I had never experienced comedy like that. Yes. It made me go back actually to the Goon Show and start listening to them.
Well, that's exactly my roots with the Goon Show. I couldn't believe there was a show where such completely sort of anarchic humour was allowed. People could say anything at any time. It wasn't the traditional sketches, beginning, middle and end. It was just people saying anything and strange noises and the most stupid and wonderful ideas.
Yeah.
And that's what we wanted to recapture with Python, was just the six of us producing what we thought was really funny. And we were indulged at the time because I don't think many other broadcasting organisations apart from the BBC would ever have put us on. And the BBC, I think, regretted it immediately when they saw the show. And there was a lot of we can't be having this. So they put it on very late at night. And it's very interesting because David Attenborough was then very, very briefly doing a desk job at the BBC. He was head of channel, I don't know what it was, head of Channel One. And I remember he was the only one from the BBC who would respond to our criticism about the BBC putting it on late at night and when people couldn't see it and all that sort of thing. I remember meeting him and I said, well, we are a bit unhappy about that. He said, well, you shouldn't be because this is the way you become a cult. And he was exactly right, as
how
he is
right
with everything.
Yeah.
And,
Let's have a listen to some of our favourite parts, and by our, I mean mine. This moment at the Bridge of Death in Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Stop! What is your name?
Sir Galahad of Camelot.
What is your quest?
I seek the Grail.
What is your favorite color?
Blue. No.
I loved that joke so much. And you fly off into the chasm below. And me and my two teenage boys, we were quoting that to each other. And they were so excited that I was going to be talking to the man who said, well, blue, no yellow.
There's a good story about that because it was done up in Glencoe in quite dramatic circumstances. There was a bridge and there was a big gorge below. And we had this wonderful man called Hamish McInnes, who was a great climber. And he was also a Python fan. He said, can I help out? And what he did was, he was the one who actually threw the bodies high in the air and then they dropped down below. I just loved the idea because he was at that time head of mountain rescue in Glencoe. So anyone coming up the hills, there's a man throwing bodies on the top. No, don't worry, he's head of mountain rescue.
Yeah, not good at his job, is he?
Yeah.
My other favourite, moving to the life of Brian, is your role as the ex-leper.
Did you say ex-leper?
That's right, sir. 16 years behind a bell, I'm proud of it, sir.
Well, what happened?
Oh, cured, sir.
Cured?
Yes, a bloody miracle, sir. God bless you.
Well, who cured you?
Jesus did, sir. I was hopping along, under my own business. All of a sudden, up he comes, cures me. One minute I'm a leper with a trade, next minute my livelihood's gone. Not so much as a by your leave.
You're cured, mate. Bloody do-gooder.
Well, why don't you go and tell him that you want to be a leper again?
Oh, I could do that, sir, yeah. Yeah, I could do that, I suppose. What I was thinking, I was going to ask him if he'd make me a bit lame in one leg during the middle of the week. You know, something beggable, but not leprosy, which is a pain in the arse, to be blunt. Excuse my French, sir.
It's good writing, though. That's John Cleese and Graham Chapman.
Yeah, but wrote that. Yeah. The writing is very good. However, it's your movement. During the whole thing, you're bouncing around. You're skipping and moving. And when I look at that, I kind of see that as a metaphor for your journey through life. That's how you navigate life in my head. This sort of gentle, curious bounce, playfulness.
Yes. Total bizarre, unreasonable optimism as he goes bashing around. Well, that's interesting. I mean, I am an optimist and I feel very, very fortunate at all the different kinds of work that I've been able to do during my life. That's really it, you know, not just the comedy, but also the travel and writing books about ships and things like that, which I've done before.
Obviously, there are the highlights of the things we've seen, but, you know, fans always wonder about the things we never got to see.
Oh, yeah.
Was there a sketch that was meant to go into The Life of Brian about The Last Supper?
Yes. Yes, there was. I mean, this is when we were trying to work out how do we approach the Bible story in terms of sort of comedy, and we realised it had to be authentic. We actually did our research and found that there was a Messiah fever in the Bethlehem and Judea at that time. But there were other ideas that we thought would be so funny, and one was that St. Peter was trying to book a table for the Last Supper. And he rings up the restaurant and the guy just says, "What? Am I 12 on a Friday? You must be joking." Well, any other day? Well, I'll do your Thursday, but three tables of four. No, we want to be all at the same table. Mate, you don't realise. I'll do your Monday, all right? Got a table on Monday. Oh, yes, and we all want to sit on the same side. I'm sorry, health and safety, can't do that. Which was very silly, but wasn't right for the film in the end. You know, we couldn't have argued that against the bishop.
Yeah, but that's the beauty of the stuff that you did, because, you know, throughout all of it, they were very sometimes big historical moments and periods, but you broke it down to the everyman.
Yes,
you know, it was the man in the street and the stuff that they would have had to deal with. And someone did have to organise a venue for the Last Supper. You know, there's someone's house had to be organised or something.
Yeah.
You know, there's these things had to be done.
We could have put that in. But I remember thinking we've got to be quite careful about whether we've got quite clear that Brian is not Jesus. And that's there from the very start.
Yes.
There are two babies in the manger and the wise men go to the wrong baby and they go to Brian and give him all the gifts. He's a very naughty boy. And that we had to sustain that. But you had to get that right. You had to show that Jesus was the other baby. And later you see an actor portraying Jesus. So people can't say, well, it's just jokes about Jesus. We wouldn't joke about Jesus. Well, I mean, Jesus, I feel, would have had a great sense of humour, because no one could entertain crowds as he did without a few laughs here and there.
Yeah, I agree. A message says, could you ask Michael to say hello to my husband, Chris Madden, who is currently reading Michael Palin's diaries? It would make his year.
Hello, Chris. November the 7th. Read Michael Palin's diaries. Fell asleep.
You've kept the diaries since before the Monty Python days. I mean,
well, only just.
Yeah, but what a great gift to yourself and the rest of us.
Well, it turned out okay. I mean, I'd been doing them for April 1969, I started because we just had our first child, Tom, and I felt I just wanted to keep a record of family life. About 3 weeks later, we had the first Python meeting, so it was quite coincidental.
Yeah.
But I didn't decide to publish them until 2006, something like that, because I thought a bit personal and all that. But then I felt, well, I'd rather have the diaries out while I'm still alive. So you can talk about them and people can argue and say this didn't happen or this did happen. So they have a life while I'm still there to sort of talk about it. And I keep a diary most days now, and I'm really glad I did.
Here's an interesting one from Floor. She says, greetings to Michael. Would you ask him if he remembers the night a gang of girls kidnapped him and took him set dancing in Cork? He was there to open an exhibition and there was a formal dinner afterwards. And halfway through, he turned to a few of us and said, get me out of here. So we took him out on the town, ended up teaching him the Siege of Limerick. He was a natural.
Oh, no, I don't remember that, my solicitor says. Thank you. If it did happen, that was wonderful.
So
that's the thing about being so old. There's an awful lot of stuff there in the attic. great attic of life.
Where do you think comedy is these days? Obviously, you know, your fellow Monty Python pal John Cleese has spoken a little bit about, you know, the... how it's become maybe you can't really say what you want to say. It's lost its edge to a certain extent. Where do you feel comedy is and where would you like to see it go?
I don't think it's as adventurous as it was in Python days. But then in Python days, there was, we were reacting against a very conventional form of comedy. It was just good old British sitcom and all that. And now I think the reaction has gone the other way and people are getting very nervous about making jokes about people who may take exception to the fact that you're making a joke about them. I mean, this was quite a while ago now, but I remember playing the stammerer in A Fish Called Wanda.
Yeah.
And we had quite a discussion afterwards. But I think a lot of people felt you shouldn't have done it. Well, no, some people felt you shouldn't have done it because it's unfair to stammerers. But most of the stammerers I talked to were very happy to hear stammering dealt with, at least in that film. You know, so I think what happens now is you've got to be a bit careful about just prescribing certain things and saying we can't make jokes about this or that because some group somewhere will complain, and they'll get others who will complain as well.
Yeah,
this is the time of social media. We didn't have that.
Yeah, can you imagine what it would have been like bringing out, say, The Life of Brian with social media?
Yeah.
I think it would have just made everything more complicated and everyone shouting louder.
Well, there was quite a lot of shouting anyway. I mean, I was told it was banned in Ireland, wasn't it?
It was for a while,
Life of Brian for a while, yeah. It was banned in a lot of places, and one of the places was Aberystwyth in Wales. And then much later on, Aberystwyth elected a mayor, and the mayor they elected was Sue Jones Davis, who played Brian's girlfriend in The Life of Brian. And, you know, she was the revolutionary. And she was so pleased, she broke the ban. Says, again, no ban in Aberystwyth for one night. We're going to show Monty Python, and Terry Jones and Michael Palin are going to walk with me to the cinema. And we went, you know, hands grasping each other as though we'd won the pool or something like that. And for one night, it was allowed to be played by the mayor of Aberystwyth, Sue Jones Davis, God bless her.
Yeah. So what's next for you then, Michael? What are you planning? What are you cooking
up? Well, just a plan to keep alive as best I can for a little bit longer. The travel shows we've done now, Venezuela was the fourth of these short travel shows, Iraq, Venezuela, North Korea. And I think they're very pleased that the success, the book's done well. So there's another one being suggested at the moment. I can't tell you where, but it's not Dublin.
Yeah. Well, look, it's been an absolute pleasure. You can tell by the many, many messages we're getting. People just love you. They love you for many, many different reasons. You know?
Oh.
So we want to thank you for the gifts that you've given us over the years. You inspired me to follow the mad career of being a comedian. Yeah. And I thank you for that.
Good. You look very well on it, really, if I may say so. It's obviously the right decision.
Yeah, well, this show isn't mine and it's only an hour long, so it's not that stressful. But look, I want to tell everyone that the book, Michael Palin in Venezuela, is out now in all good bookshops, as they say. And you can catch his show about Venezuela on Virgin Media Telly as well. So, Michael Palin, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Dermot. Really nice to talk to you.
You too. Take a break now.
Email oliver@rte.ie.